have some students who are joining us, and while they are joining us, I give you a little information that might be a little different on this case. Respondents' counsel has asked to do argument seated because she was wildly dancing and broke her ankle, right? Or some such thing. In any case, she's going to do her argument in a seated position, and the marshal will be giving her time with cards like we do on the road. So if you think something different is going on, you're right, it is, because she can't really very well see the lights that are going on. So we can easily accommodate to that. We have a number of students that are joining us this morning. And so I think they're just about in. Our marshal thought they wouldn't be here when the the argument started, but it appears that they have joined us. So it is the Fort Washington High School. Is that who we have today? Would you all please stand so we can see you all and get a good look at you? Oh, my, a nice group. Very good. Thank you. Thank you for coming, and you may be seated. The students are with us today as part of Court with Class, which is a combined program of the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. And they get information about the case before they join us. Is there anybody that would like additional information that the marshal has and can give to you at this time? Okay, it looks like you're well settled and ready to go. I have one other little matter to bring to your attention. The lawyers are always very good about stopping when the red light goes on. And for the students, when the lawyers get up to speak, they get a green light to start, they get a yellow light when they have 5 minutes to go, and they get a red light when they're to stop. Now, today, the marshal's going to be assisting that with cards as well, telling them when to start and when they should conclude. And the lawyers are very good about stopping when their time is up, and we allot each side 30 minutes. We do that so we treat both sides the same. Sometimes, however, we justices don't pay so much attention to the light, and we have become concerned that it may appear either the counsel or the people watching us on Wisconsin Eye that we are not treating both sides equally. So we're going to try very hard today to stay within the time limits, just like you always do so. And one other small matter before we begin, since we have all the students here, and you were nice enough to stand up and identify yourselves to us, I'd like to introduce the court to you. On my far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. Next to me, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. On my left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley.
Good morning.
Next to her, Justice David Prosser. And at the end of the bench, Justice Michael Gableman. So I think with all those preliminaries, we are now ready to call the first case this morning, State versus Valdez, 14-678. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please begin.
Well, counsel, you know that the seat next to me is empty, and that's because a justice will not be participating, but not for the usual reason of recusal or disqualification, but that Justice Crooks passed away earlier in the latter part of September. We're sitting six.
Yeah, please begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Mark Christopher, and I represent Ms. Melissa Valdez in this matter. I also represented her before the Walworth County Circuit Court. Ms. Valdez is a legal permanent resident. She entered the United States with her family as a child. At ages 18 and 19, she incurred three separate criminal cases resulting in four convictions for possession of controlled substances. In each one of these cases, she was not read the immigration warning by the circuit court judge as mandated in 971-08. 8 years after these convictions, now a single mother of three children, she came into my office to renew her legal permanent residence card, as she's required to do. She was seeking to go visit her family abroad in Mexico. This is normally a very routine procedure for someone who practices immigration law. However, one of the major things that one does is does a criminal background check. It was after this criminal background check that we learned of her very precarious and dire immigration situation. The issue before this court is what must Ms. Valadez, a legal permanent resident, show in order to vacate her plea under 97108.
Now, she has to renew her legal permanent residence, as I understand it,
yes, every
she does. 10 years.
You have to do so every 10
has
years.
Has she renewed?
She has not. And the reason she has not renewed is because she would subject herself to the very thing that we're trying to avoid.
Which is that the immigration services get their attention focused on her.
And that's what we explained to the circuit court, is that when somebody has to renew their LPR card, essentially what happens is they have to undergo what's called a biometrics. And as part of that biometrics, they undergo an FBI background check and also an interagency check. So in that particular case, by simply applying for the LPR card, what we're doing is we're going to avail her to a system that we're essentially trying to avoid, a circumstance that we're trying to avoid.
Counselor, how long ago did she first get legal permanent residence?
She became a permanent resident in 2001 as a child.
Before her convictions.
Correct, before her convictions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So what I want this court, and I would like this court to focus on, and what I've tried to get the circuit court to focus on, is that there are three very different consequences that are contemplated in the statute. The first one is exclusion of admission. That's when Ms. Valadez would leave the United States and have to affirmatively apply for admission back into the United States. The second is denial of naturalization, which, again, unlike deportation, is an affirmative step that one person must make. And then finally, that she is likely to be deported.
Well, isn't the language of the statute likely to be either deported or denied admission or denied naturalization?
Exactly. So it's like the likely element applies to all three of these particular consequences. And I don't think that there's any question, and at least I hope that there's none, that after reviewing the circuit court submissions, what I submitted to the Walworth County judge, and after reading these briefs, I don't think that there's any question that Ms. Valadez will automatically be inadmissible the very minute that she steps outside of the United States. Her admission is a legal and practical impossibility.
You've set that forth in your brief and in the reply brief, but I want you to further elaborate why that is rather than making the blanket statement.
Certainly. Ms. Valadez is a legal permanent resident, but when she leaves the United States, she's no longer governed by the rules of removability, or as we would think of it, deportability. Instead, once she leaves the United States, by having these specific convictions, and there are enumerated convictions in the law, when she attempts to come back in, she's no longer coming back in as a legal permanent resident. She's applying for admission. And under the law, any of these four controlled substance violations that they have, even though they're just simple possession, will make her automatically inadmissible the minute she applies for admission with Customs and Border Protection. So in the past, before 1996, if you were a legal permanent resident, you left the United States, you came back in, you wouldn't be applying for admission again. But that law changed in 1996. So now the federal statute states that if you're a legal permanent resident and you've been convicted of a controlled substance violation, you leave the United States, you have to apply for admission. And through that process, again, we tried to describe that and provide evidence of that process to the circuit court, you will not be admitted 100%.
So, counsel, what I hear you saying is under the statute, where the nexus has to be between the plea is likely to result in deportation, exclusion from admission, or denial of naturalization.
Right.
What I hear from you is, while that might be tougher to prove when you're talking about deportation,
when you're talking about exclusion from admission, it's pretty clear.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the reason for that is you have to understand what the process one goes through when you're applying for admission. Admission, unlike deportation, is an affirmative step that an alien will present. So in other words, you present yourself for admission, or you present yourself, or you file an application for naturalization. Deportation works very much like a criminal proceeding. In other words, that's not something that an individual avails themselves to. Immigration and Customs Enforcement would issue a warrant or arrest, and then they would put someone in immigration removal proceedings, where it acts very, very much like a criminal proceeding. The Department of Homeland Security would allege charges, and there would be opportunities for waivers, prosecutorial discretion, things that I know that this court is very aware of. But in the case of admission, there are specific enumerated laws which absolutely 100% deny admission, and there's no discretion.
Well, the state says, if I understand their brief, the state says you did a fine job of showing that the judge did not give the warning that the legislature has required that he give. No one debates that, right? The judge did not say, hey, if you plead or found guilty, you may be subject to immigration problems.
Correct.
That's not the exact words of the statute, but that's close enough, right?
Correct.
There's no question about that. The state doesn't dispute that, that the trial court erred by not giving those instructions, that admonition. But, says the state, we also agree with you that the federal law says, okay, you can be deported because of these drug crimes. You can be denied admission to the country because of the drug crimes. And you can't be naturalized because of the drug crimes. States, the statute is clear as a bell. You are right. But, says the state, you haven't shown that any of these are likely to happen. How long has she been in the country and not a legally permanent resident?
She's been in the country since 2001.
Okay, 2001. So now it's 13 or 14 years, or at trial maybe 10 years. And has anyone come after her?
No one has yet.
No one has come after her. So says the state. It's not likely. You haven't shown it's likely that under the Negrete case, you have to show not that the statute, federal statute, says you're out of here and you can't come in here, but that the government, the federal government, is doing something to you that will allow them to get rid of you or make life tougher here for you. Right? So the state says you haven't shown that. Negrete requires you to show it. You tried very hard to get the INS to do that, right?
Correct.
And the trial court gave you a continuance to do it,
correct,
right? So you had all this time. The trial court bent over backwards to let you get the evidence that shows that the Immigration Service is going to be after your client. And you produced what best you could produce, but it wasn't good enough to show they're really going to come after you.
Sure.
And after you soon, right?
Correct.
So how do you get over the state's argument that under Negrete you lose?
I think it's very clear. Negrete looked at this matter within the context of deportation and set a standard within the context of deportation.
Right.
That standard that the state set, or that this court set forth in Negrete, cannot practically apply to admission, and it cannot apply to naturalization.
And what's the standard of Negrete that can't apply?
That you would have to get some type of affirmative response from the government. They have to manifest their showing that they're trying to, and I think within the context of deportation, initiate deportation proceedings. But the reason that that's not workable in this particular situation is because the nature of admission. When you leave the United States and come back in, the federal government or Customs and Border Protection, they don't ask you, they don't say, hey, listen, you know, we're probably not going to admit you because you have these convictions, you better take care of them. You apply for admission and you get denied. So in this particular case, within the context of deportation, if that's the standard that this court wishes to go forward with, perhaps they may want to do that. But I would also say, before, you know, I can see that step, in Negretti, we didn't know what Negretti's immigration status was, number one. In Negretti, we didn't know the connection between his crime and the applicable INA statute, or federal statute, which would make him deportable. In this case, we do. We know that Ms. Valadez is a legal permanent resident. We know that this controlled substance links up with this ground of inadmissibility, that links up with this ground of removability, and we've connected the dots. And I think what we did in this particular case, I tried to go above and beyond. What I did is I provided policy, USCIS policy memos, which talk about what you have to go through to renew your LPR status, what you have to go through when you apply for naturalization. And if you look at what I submitted to them, I indicated to the judge that they would have to go, Ms. Valadez would have to go through a criminal background check.
Counsel, I initially asked my questions because I was trying to carve out the three areas of the law, deportation, which we have some case law on.
Correct.
Exclusion from admission, which means can't come back, right? Or denial of naturalization. I thought your answer to me was, I'm really not trying to prove that the plea is likely to result in deportation. Is that correct or not?
That's correct. And I think...
I hear you saying the plea results in your client not being able to get back in the country if she goes and visits friends, family, whomever, outside of the country.
Absolutely.
And so I thought you were asking us not to revisit, is the plea likely to result in deportation, but instead, because you couldn't prove that, she hasn't been deported because of that plea.
Correct.
Right?
I mean, correct.
So when you were answering Justice Abramson's questions, I got a little lost. I wanted to make sure we were back on point with what you really are arguing, which is you're saying the plea would result in denial of admission, right?
Correct.
And
yes,
that you're saying there's zero room that she will get back in the country. And so it means, really, as a matter of law, that it's likely because it's certain.
Correct.
Right? It's really interesting because no one's made that argument. I dealt with the plea likely to result in deportation argument at the trial court and also here, but that's an interesting argument. But then why even bother with any argument about the plea likely to result in deportation? Why shouldn't everyone just fast forward to, I didn't get my warnings, and so if I ever want to leave the country, I'm not going to be allowed back in, end of the analysis, and we don't really need all our case law on is a plea likely to result in deportation.
In Ms. Valadez's case, absolutely.
Well, absolutely. What case wouldn't it be in? I mean, anyone could say, look, I may want to leave the country someday, and if I do, I'm not getting back in. And so it really swallows the whole. I mean, it makes our case law somewhat irrelevant, I think.
Well, I don't think necessarily. Ms. Valadez is a legal permanent resident. There are laws that specifically make a legal permanent resident inadmissible when they come back in. Not all crimes are inadmissible crimes. Not all crimes are removable crimes. Not all crimes result in denial of naturalization. Ironically enough, there are some crimes that result in inadmissibility, but they don't result in removability. So I think it's important for the attorney, you know, someone in my position, to connect those dots. And I think the problem with the Negretti issue was the attorney said, here's a crime, he's going to be deportable. And he did.
Crime in Negretti.
Yeah, I believe it was a second-degree sexual assault.
That's right. And so that's not in the list of mandatory deportation crimes, right?
Well, there is sexual assault is the general heading. But, you know, what I would say in Valadez's case is that the controlled substance is extremely clear. And I think, you know, I mean, I don't want to bring up...
It's extremely clear that it's mandated deportation if they come out after her, right?
Absolutely.
All right. So under the federal law, it's mandated deportation. It's mandated no admission if she leaves, and it's mandated no naturalization.
Correct.
So it seems to me that you should apply the same rule to all of them, which is, under Negretti, that the statute, the federal statute, is not alone on mandating is not enough. That what you need is a showing that the INS is out after your client. That's what Negretti said. Mm-hmm. Now, I agree Negretti is a sex offense. I agree for the moment that that may be discretionary versus mandated, and that's why you don't have to overrule Negretti. Isn't that right?
Correct.
You can win without overruling Negretti.
Oh, absolutely.
Because
absolutely.
You just distinguish it, right?
Absolutely.
Well, why doesn't your client leave the country? Then, when she tries to come back, they're not going to let her, and she's going to prove the likelihood. She's going to be sitting outside Wisconsin and outside the United States and can't get back in. I mean, that's a slight problem.
And never, to be honest with you, she will never get back in, ever.
Right. Once she gets out, she won't get back in.
Right.
So you can't show the likelihood.
Right. I mean, at that point, it's a certainty.
That's right.
It's a certainty. And that's the catch-22, and I think... That's why the Court of Appeals, when they requested cert on this, they said that was one of the questions. Given that this is a certainty, does she have to leave the United States to be denied in order to prove the likelihood prong? And that's – our case is 100% on that.
Well, as the Court of Appeals wrote, the issue here in this case is how likely is likely.
Counselor, I want to talk a little bit about the time, because there's an argument on the other side that this wasn't timely made, and I don't want you to have used up all your time and not have a chance to address that particular issue. These convictions were 11 and 12 years ago, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And she's not claiming she's innocent, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So there is a concern that the state is going to be prejudiced by her waiting this period of time if she withdraws her plea, and they have to prove them up again. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I don't think the state, if I read their brief correctly, is really arguing that point. I think that they understand that this is one of those exceptional statutes that can be brought up at any time. And from a practical standpoint, if we want this statute to have any meaning whatsoever, these are situations whereby an individual doesn't know, like in Ms. Valadez's case, you don't know until you talk to an immigration practitioner.
I thought the state brought up that there was a concern about your client waiting a long period of time, or not some other client waiting a long period of time and then bringing it up, so that essentially the state would be sandbagged about this error causing a concern for your client.
Well, I guess I didn't read that part in their brief, but I think what this court has said in the Duong Mala case is that this is of such importance that there is no harmless error analysis. And on top of that, this is a statutory provision. So in this particular case, the legislature has said that if you do not provide this warning, and if this defendant shows that it is likely to result in one of the three enumerated consequences, the court shall. And it doesn't talk about, you know, obviously a state could be prejudiced from bringing the charges again, but that's not a concern. That's not what the statute itself says.
Thank you.
How do you reconcile your answer to Justice Abramson with Shada?
With Shada, I think that Shada obviously looks at a Sixth Amendment ineffective assistance of counsel, which is a judicially created doctrine. What we're doing here is we're looking at the narrow focus of a directive from the legislature. And that directive from the legislature is very different from that of Shada. Shada looked at the Sixth Amendment and whether or not his counsel provided him effective assistance of counsel. Very different in this particular case is the warning that is mandated by this legislature. And if it's not followed, then, as a matter of right, that individual has the right to come back, show the causal nexus between the crime and the immigration consequence, and then vacate their plea. So I think you have to look at Shada within the context of Sixth Amendment, a judicially created doctrine, and you have to look at this within the context of a statutory directive.
And that was true also of the Ortiz case.
Correct.
It was a counsel.
Correct.
These were decided in July of 2015.
Correct.
Right? And I think you cite that in the brief. If you don't, the other... they were cited in the brief.
Correct.
Shada was cited in
yes.
the brief. I think that what was being driven at in the question about a time period for seeking relief was the issue that the Court of Appeals raised, which was... that footnote, 14 on Romero Giordana said that there may be a problem where the defendant raises a 971-08 to motion, and in that case, it was the third motion made.
Correct.
There were two other post-conviction motions because removing, there are no time constraints in 971-082, isn't that right?
Correct.
No statutory ones.
Correct.
And you're not asking us to read one in, are you?
Absolutely not.
But the Court of Appeals was thought maybe this footnote is indicating that this court's going to read a time period in, and the court said removing all time constraints of the 971-082 motion would frustrate judicial efficiency by encouraging defendants to delay the motion. And in the absence of a time limit, then, in effect, the defendant could game the system. That's what the court said. Didn't use those terms, but indicate how it could game the system. And that... they didn't address it because in Romero it was a 974-06, not a 971-082. In this case, it's a 971-082. So how do you answer? How do you want this court to answer the Court of Appeals question that the Court of Appeals posed on certification? We can say, hey, we don't have to answer it, right?
Sure.
But we don't have to answer every question that the Court of Appeals submits. So what would the answer be if we were polite and answered the question?
I would encourage, obviously, that there would not be a time limit. There is nothing in the statute which creates a statutory time limit. And the issue is you don't know, and someone like Ms. Valadez is a permanent resident who came here as a child, doesn't know what she doesn't know. And you don't realize that sometimes. As I indicated, you have to renew your LPR status every 10 years. Immigration may not manifest their intent until she reapplies. And that might be 9 years, 8 years.
Well, she's not a lawful permanent resident today because if she got
yes.
it 2001, she would have had to renew it after she got her conviction in the 10-year period, and she wouldn't.
I know my red light is on, but she is. Under the law, she is still a legal permanent resident. What the card demonstrates, it shows, it's her proof that she's a legal permanent resident. As strange as that sounds, that's how it works out.
Even though she didn't renew that card?
Correct.
So she's still a legal permanent resident. What does that give her? What rights does that give her?
Well, basically everything except for being able to vote and serve on a jury, but the problem that she runs into is that she can't demonstrate that. She can't use her expired LPR card to get a social to get a driver's license. She can't use it as a form of identification. And so, therefore, she's stuck in this kind of limbo. I know, as weird as that sounds, he's still an LPR.
What about why not a driver's license?
Well, you have to show proof of legal status in the United States in order to obtain a driver's license.
So your argument is she has legal status as a permanent resident, but not for driver's purposes or other purposes.
Right. It's a catch-22 for her. She's a legal permanent resident, but she can't prove it.
Thank you very much, counsel.
And they can deport her if they want to.
Absolutely, at any time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Noah, can you see the lights from where you are?
I've been practicing, looking over a bit, and I will try to be very mindful.
That's why I watched you practicing. All right.
I'm going to try to.
Tina's going
to
help you, too, in the cards today. I think we're in good shape.
Between the two sides, I will try to make.
How's your peripheral vision?
I'm getting better these days because I'm more paranoid about where I am.
Well, you should be.
And I'll just tell you, no one was more shocked than I when the earthquake hit Nepal as I was summiting Everest, which is how this happened.
Wow.
I'm telling that story because the truth is just not satisfying.
I like the story, though. And
it's a good
story. I'll swear I was with you.
That would be a pair to draw to.
Yeah, the sad
truth. And I carried you down.
I'm sorry?
And I carried you down.
You did, and I've
Your
never been more grateful.
Your green light is on, by the way.
Yes, thank you.
That's right.
First, I'd like to say, I agree with opposing counsel, and I think some sentiments from the court. The court's failure to give the warning here is clearly still a problem. And so whatever happens in terms of the court's decision on the specifics here, I assume and hope that this case will be another message to the circuit courts to read the warning to defendants.
The rub of the case is, in all of these cases, tends to be, I think, how do you know someone's deported because of their plea versus being deported because they are of illegal status?
Well, that's
That's the issue. How do we know the difference?
Well, and I think, unfortunately, proceedings at the circuit court level, and so haven't filtered their way up here, we haven't gotten to a point where that proof has kind of been called. And I think that was a point I brought up at least tangentially in the previous cases last spring, Shada and Ortiz Mondragon. That is an important distinction, and certainly in the ineffective assistance of counsel realm, I think it speaks more to prejudice. Perhaps than deficient performance, but there are many non-citizen defendants or even lawful permanent residents who may face deportation for reasons separate and independent from certain criminal convictions, at which point, if they've received ineffective assistance of counsel, are they truly prejudiced, given that they will be sent from the country anyway? I will tell you, Mr. Shada was deported for reasons separate and apart from his conviction, having prevailed at the Court of Appeals.
People keep using the word deportation. I think we have some case law on deportation, and the court isn't 7-0 on that issue, or at least in the past hasn't been. This case, though, I think counsel is framing in terms of not the plea will result in deportation, but rather the plea is certain to result in exclusion from admission. From my perspective, that's something you need to address.
No, absolutely. And there is certainly a distinction between admissibility and deportation. And it speaks again to the complexity and often confusing nature of immigration law. Possession of THC, 30 grams or less. Can you be removed? No. Are you inadmissible? Quite likely. Yes. And so the difference here, though, again, circles back to the statute. And you brought the point up earlier, Justice Ziegler. Are the convictions here likely to lead to the results? Now, in the Shada and Ortiz Mondragon context, I think we were talking about likelihood in terms of counsel's advice to their clients, the likelihood that they would face these consequences leading, down the road. Here we're talking about whether those are likely actually to happen. And Ms. Valadez is in a position, and it is the state's position, as Justice Abrahamson brought up, that unfortunately or not, the proof just wasn't there, at least at the pleading stage. And I want to make sure we recognize that distinction. There are pleading requirements, but then there comes a hearing. And I think we have to talk about both what the pleading requirements are and then what the proof at that hearing would look like. And here, despite an opportunity to provide sufficient proof at least to get beyond the pleading stage, Ms. Valadez didn't come up with the goods. You know, her attorney said here at oral argument, we need someone like me to connect the dots. I agree with him. I think we need some expert evidence here, perhaps from an immigration specialist, perhaps from an agent or a prosecutor at ICE who would confirm that based on your client's convictions, I will tell you it would, is the government's intent to do this, whether it would be removal. And by the way, in terms of admissibility, while she would be inadmissible based on her convictions, were she, Ms. Valadez or anyone in her position, to try to reenter the country, detected by the authorities, which I think she probably would be, she'd be put in removal proceedings. She would get her day in court. She wouldn't just sit outside of the country unable to air her claims that
she'd be in some detention center.
Yes, she likely would be taken. I believe custody would be mandatory in these circumstances.
I have a question for you. Suppose, if I'm hearing you right, suppose that the foremost expert for immigrants on immigration law is brought in and she testifies, hey, with these convictions, these drug convictions, it is mandatory deportation. It is a mandatory non-admissibility if you leave the country. And it's mandatory that you cannot be naturalized. Okay? I mean, I want to make it as, if you don't like my use of the word mandatory, you can substitute it. But this is what the law of immigration is, right? I mean, that's what I heard you say. Now, is that good enough for the state?
I don't think it's enough to say that this is what the law is. I think to comport with the statute and negrete, it would have to be someone, a competent witness who could say, not just based on the law, but based on his or her experience with how the federal system works, this is likely to happen. The government will do this. It is the government's intent to do this. That's...
Wait. Okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
You know, I read with interest your brief as to what it said and what it does not say. With regard to exclusion from admissibility and denial of naturalization, I didn't find much in your brief at all regarding those. It seemed, and so I thought, well, have you acknowledge, I mean, you just haven't argued it. So do you agree with the defense here, as he has said in his brief at counsel and here at oral argument, that denial of admission is an absolute certainty based on the law?
I believe, given her convictions, Ms. Valadez is inadmissible, yes.
Okay.
But neither the statute nor negrete says that's good enough. The standard is other.
Let me pursue that then. It seems like you are acknowledging, and I then did read your brief correctly by what it didn't address, that you're acknowledging that it's an absolute certainty that she won't be allowed to be admitted. Doesn't that meet the statutory standard that it's likely that she won't be admitted? The statute, of course, as we've already indicated, has three elements: likely to result in the defendant's deportation, exclusion from admission to this country, or denial of naturalization, reading from sub 2. You've just indicated that it is an absolute certainty that there will be exclusion from admission for her, given her convictions. Doesn't that meet the likely to result in standard?
I believe negrete says no.
Well, negrete dealt with, in large part, the issue was, and the problem advanced, was we didn't have a transcript. And so what do you have to do when you don't have a transcript and you're arguing deportation? That's what the issue primarily was. I know there's a discussion regarding footnote 4, but the body of the opinion, that's what the case was about. And so you're saying that even, I get a little, officer of justice sort of thing, because that's what you are. And you seem to be saying that you agree 100% that she will not be, that she will be excluded from admission, that the plea is, but it doesn't meet the statutory standard. Or am I misunderstanding you?
I agree with you that Negrete, certainly the primary issue in that case was the fact that the defendant did not have a transcript of the proceedings. And unlike that defendant, Ms. Valadez does have a transcript to show the warnings didn't happen. That said, I think the language of Negrete, comporting with the statute, is clear. There are two requirements. One, laying out under federal law the fact that she is inadmissible, and I agree with that. She's got number one, but there is a number two, and I don't think it's limited to a circumstance. I don't think that part of the opinion is limited to a circumstance in which a transcript is absent. A defendant still must satisfy the requirements under 97108 sub 2.
Let's look at note 8 then in Negrete. In part says, this required nexus between the crime, reading from footnote 8, to which a plea was made, and adverse immigration consequences can, that to me means can, but isn't shall, isn't must, it isn't exclusive, but can be demonstrated by alleging facts that show that because of his plea, the defendant has become subject to deportation, has been excluded from admission. When reading that, it is a little difficult for me to understand that the defendant has to show that he has been or she has been excluded from admission in order to meet the statutory standard that the plea is likely to result in exclusion for admission. There seems to be some tension there. Do you agree? And if so, how can that be resolved?
I would resolve it by referring to the sentence that begins the paragraph from which you just read. In addition, in such a motion seeking relief from a plea, a defendant should allege that the federal government has conveyed its intent to impose one of the enumerated consequences. The paragraph then goes on with the language you just laid out. So, in a conversation let's say, a prosecutor at ICE, counsel is able to confirm, yes, based on what you've told me about your client, this is what the government will do to your client because these are our policies. Here's what we will do and why.
One of the things in your brief, several times you talk about the government initiating the action, and that seems to be appropriate and consistent with deportation. But the government doesn't initiate action with regard to that denial of admission or denial of naturalization. It is reactive. So I just don't see how that really comports with 100% certainty of exclusion of admission, not meeting the statutory requirement of likelihood to be excluded.
But again, I think we're not talking about the likelihood that she would be inadmissible. It's the likelihood that she would be excluded as inadmissible. It's the likelihood of the result.
I know, but I mean, you look at the certification of the Court of Appeals and some of the questions and answers with your opposing counsel, appropriately so, addressed his arguments, but they weren't addressing the Court of Appeals certification, which had two primary arguments, one timeliness and the first asking us to take a look at the how definite it has to be. But within the body of that certification, it had all sorts of interrogatories in paragraphs 16 and 7, or pages, I think, 6 and 7, rather, and page maybe 14. That
was focused on deportation in large part. But we're here talking about something else because it is your opposing counsel that's focusing on exclusion from admission. It is, to me, inconsistent with logic that you have to be denied with total certainty admissibility in order to meet a much lesser standard of likelihood. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I don't know. I'd like to step back just a little bit, and you speak of this absolute certainty with respect to inadmissibility, and again, I think negrete speaks to the result, and so I have to reiterate that. But Ms. Valadez presents, the facts in her case present a simple fact scenario, and I would remind the court again to consider, particularly when we're talking about what the standard ought to be here, that cases are not nearly always this simple.
But here we have 100% certainty that she would be excluded from admission. Does that or does that not meet the likelihood test?
Well, she would be likely excluded as admissible if she leaves the country and tries to come back. That's an if. And it's one that negrete seems to indicate is too speculative. It hasn't happened.
That's the question that the Court of Appeals raises and says, what a catch-22. They say, I can pull out the language, but it seems, they say, I'll paraphrase, a little odd that they have to be denied admission in order to prove the likelihood that they can't be admitted.
Admittedly, there are a lot of unappealing aspects to how federal immigration law impacts, one of the 11 million plus immigrants we have in our country. That said, I don't think our standard for preserving pleas in this context ought to be dependent on the whim, frankly, and complexity of federal law in that arena.
Final question, and then I'll stop. And that is on page 7, the court of the certification. The Court of Appeals asks us to answer this. Must Valadez leave the country and be denied readmission to show that she has suffered the immigration consequences? What's your answer, if you have one? You may not have one.
Again, I think short of that, with an appropriate, competent opinion from, you could pick, I think, from a number of different practitioners, immigration lawyers, perhaps, they contacted an agent from Homeland Security in this case who didn't give them the answer, but I think might have been able to, I don't know, or a prosecutor who can say, yes, that is what would happen to her. Submit an affidavit. We didn't get any of that here. I don't know why that is. I mean, I can think of practical reasons why, someone at Homeland Security might not want to commit to a very certain answer in a specific case. That said, I think it's possible.
Do you have to give the agent the name of Ms. Velez and all the facts and then have the agent say, yeah, she's deportable or she would be excluded or she cannot be naturalized? Is that the kind of affidavit you're looking for?
I think you'd have to have an accurate representation of her status, not her name necessarily.
Ms. V. And then the immigration person would say, yep, deportable, mandatory deportation, mandatory exclusion, mandatory naturalization. That still doesn't satisfy Negrete that the INS is coming out after her.
I agree. There has to be a little bit more. Yes, the government intends and will do this.
Okay. And that the government is going to do this to this person soon. Right? That's what you need.
I don't know if I would throw soon in there, but will happen.
But the government is supposed, just by reading the statute, you know that the government has the power to do these things. What you don't know is when they're going to do it. And under Negrete, you have to have something in your hands that indicates they're out after you.
Essentially, yes. And I don't know if it has to be when, but it's the if.
Yeah. So why do you need anything more than the statute when the statute says the government is going to exclude you? The government is not going to naturalize you. The statute says that. Why isn't it? And that's the defendant's position here. That's good enough. If I've misstated your position, you can correct it later. And you're saying, no, the statute's not good enough. You've got to have someone that's going to testify to that. Well, okay, I'll testify to that. But I can't tell you that the government is going to come out after you because they got 11 million other people that they may have to come out after. And I picked up a article from the Madison newspaper about a Madison dad facing deportation for smoking weed as a teenager. He's lived here for a long time. He was a chef at the Nakoma Country Club. And one day, there was a knock on his door, under this newspaper article, a knock on the door, and there was a very nice INS lady, ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and he hoped that she was there following up on his request for a permanent residency, and that finally they were going to get to him. But that isn't what she was there for. She was there with a second officer, and they told him they had a warrant for his arrest and that would not answer any of his questions. They took him to into detention in handcuffs to the Milwaukee office. This happened in Madison, to the Milwaukee office, and told him he had abandoned his citizenship petition and he was going to be deported because he had a marijuana possession conviction dating back to 1996.
That's very interesting, Justice Abrahamson, but Justice Prosser's been waiting to ask a question.
My question is, you don't know when it's going to happen, when the knock on the door is going to happen. And there are several other examples of that from the media. And I just accept it as true. I don't believe everything I read, but it's probably close enough, our point. So you need more here. And you're relying on a greet.
Yes, I am.
For all of that. And you need a nexus. You have to, the nexus is there by law, which may not have been true in the greet, because that may have been more discretionary. But you need a nexus, and you need to show that's why they're going to deport you.
Yes.
And that's what you're okay.
Justice Prosser?
Ms. Valendez became a legal permanent resident in 2001. Is there any time limit at all for her to seek naturalization? Is there any time limit for her to seek naturalization?
I don't know that there's a time limit. She remains a lawful permanent resident. She simply hasn't renewed her card. And obviously, and I do agree with counsel that when and if she were to go through that process, likely her convictions would come to light.
Okay. Well, I think she could have years before she sought naturalization.
She may never seek naturalization.
That's absolutely true. Yet it seems to me the statute speaks about naturalization as one of those likely that you're not going to get naturalization in the wake of failure to notify. So if we were just focusing on naturalization, how would you present the case that there was justification for plea withdrawal?
Are you talking about proving the likely prong under Negrete? I think, again, it would be a competent witness, perhaps, again, a representative of ICE, whether it be a prosecutor or an agent or an attorney who has practiced in the field. Mr. Christopher might well be qualified to swear out an affidavit and say, with my experience, and based on my experience, a person with these convictions will be, by the federal government, denied naturalization, and here's why. Again, I think you need a little bit more from a representative, perhaps, of the government to say, this is what we will do. This is the government's intent. We will deny an application for naturalization. And we don't have it in this case. I think this case is a lot about the absence of proof. And then, obviously, we're discussing about how that would happen in the future.
Do we have an immigration problem in this country?
Boy.
That's a trick question.
You ain't just a kidding. Boy, you know, I'd love to hold forth on concerns about federal immigration policy.
Well, what I'm really trying to get at is it the highest and best use of an immigration agent to be coming and testifying at these hearings?
These things may prove, as a practical matter, difficult. I absolutely acknowledge that.
Well, is Negrete, as you pronounce it?
That's how my co-worker who argued the case pronounces the name, and so in deference to her, that's how I say it. I hope I'm right. I don't know.
Should it be revised with respect to some of these elements?
Some of those elements are specifically the likely to result.
The with relation to naturalization and readmission to the country?
I guess I would leave that to the court. I mean, you can go a couple of different ways. The reality is the case law is quite clear. Circuit courts are to give this warning, and when they don't, the consequences in terms of plea withdrawal can in certain circumstances be severe. If the court wants to come down hard on that and say you didn't do it, and at least with respect to naturalization and admission, which admittedly there's somewhat of a distinction between those two consequences and deportation, this is the case to do it.
Well, it seems to me if we set the standard too high in these hearings, it almost excuses the failure of a judge to give the warning.
That may well be the case. I agree with you.
Thank you.
You know, Ms. Nowit, earlier in a response to Justice Bradley, you indicated in your defense of your position, which I'm going to just say it, it's not really your position. You're giving a plain reading to the language in I say Negrete. And it seems to me what you're sitting here doing is defending language in our opinion. And it seems to me that some members of the bench, from their questions and comments, do not like the natural consequence of the language in our opinion in Negrete. And that language is that in addition to the general idea that someone would be excluded from readmission to this country, the department must manifest its intent as to the defendant. And so it seems to me your argument rests on the particularity requirement in Negrete. That seems to me what you're saying. Is that right?
Yes.
Now, in response to a question from Justice Bradley, you said, well, something along the lines, the word you used is whim. It shouldn't depend on the whim of the government in enforcing as to whether someone's going to be excluded. So, do you agree with the idea that because the law, as it exists now, the federal law would prohibit someone in Ms. Valadez's position from being readmitted into the country, that there is that 100% certainty that she will be excluded from readmission? Or do I infer correctly that you see some room where that might not be the case by the use of the word whim?
Well, I guess I would say it this way. If Ms. Valadez, as she apparently has for the last at least 10 years, remains in the country, she's not going to be excluded from admission because it won't happen.
What if she does? What if she goes outside, she comes back? Do you agree with the idea that there's a 100% certainty that she will be denied readmission?
I'll get to the whim. If the state of the federal law remains the same, and that's a big if,
right.
Yes, she will be inadmissible if she leaves the country and attempts to return.
No, that's a different question. You said, and you just said, you used the word inadmissible, which is different from sometimes the operation of law.
Well, she's inadmissible is her status. Exclusion is what would happen after, if she were to try to return after leaving the country, they would likely run her fingerprints, find out that, you know, about her criminal convictions, place her in custody, and put her in removal proceedings, at which point, based on those convictions, assuming they stood, she would then be excluded from admission and sent out of the country and removed.
Likely. Do we? What does it depend on? I'm just trying to focus in on why, you know, that really caught my attention when you used the word whim, I guess. What were you referring to?
I think it, and I wasn't entirely clear about it, but when I talk about whim, I'm talking about the complexity of immigration law and determining likely, and it's easy here. Remember earlier I said Ms. Valadez presents an easy case because it's drug convictions. It's easy to look at the federal statute and say inadmissible. And she's removable as well, given the nature of a couple of her convictions. That said, that's not always true. As this court is aware, in the Ortiz-Mondragon case, crimes involving moral turpitude are incredibly nebulous, very murky. Aggravated felonies. What's an aggravated felony? And when you get into that realm and you have a defendant who has those kinds of convictions, how do you get to likely?
The red light is on.
Yes, it is.
I have
a
question. But as to drug conviction, which is not in the Negrete case, as to a drug conviction, is that mandated to be deported, unlike the murky areas you're talking about?
There are exceptions. Again, it's possession of marijuana, 30 grams or less, is an exception to removability, but not admissibility.
Right. But let's suppose this was more than 30 grams. Is that definite then that she's deported? She will be deported if they catch her and decide they're going to do that?
I don't think, again, I'm going to say it's never definite or automatic that someone will be deported. She would be deportable. Yes.
I have a question about that. Page 13 and 14 of your brief, you can look at it or not look at it. I'll paraphrase it or read it verbatim. But the question was previously advanced to you as to whether or not you were standing there on behalf of the department and embracing our precedent. As I read on page 13 of your brief, going on to page 14, it says, like many similar defendants, Valadez did not pursue additional post-conviction relief beyond the motions underlying this consolidated appeal. Next sentence. Even if she had, however, her 971-082 claims should not be barred later because they are not yet viable. I saw that with some dissonance to footnote 14 in our Romero Gargana case. I mean, I don't think you're embracing the time limit suggested for a 971-082.
No, I'm not, and I don't. I certainly don't think it's operable here. As the court pointed out earlier, the defendant in Romero Gargana had filed several post-conviction motions already on notice because he had been served with a detainer from Homeland Security that he was subject to immigration proceedings. So with knowledge of a ripe claim, he sat on it. And that's what I think Romero Gargana in that footnote speaks to, and that's certainly not what's going on here.
And you are not advocating that there be a time limit. Is it correct? You are not advocating that there be a time limit imposed on 971-082 claims. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Counsel. Rebuttal, please.
Thank you again.
Given Counsel's arguments, do we need to fine-tune some language in Negrete?
Well, I think that perhaps Negrete practically is unworkable for purposes of admission. And it's unworkable for purposes of naturalization.
So So negret should be tethered to a deportation case, which in your view is different from admission or denial of naturalization.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I fully understand what this court was asking in negret. It's asking, it took a factual situation whereby there was no transcript, whereby we didn't know the individual's status. We didn't know the connection between the law and the crime. And Negret is saying, create a causal nexus. Don't make the circuit court guess. That's very, very different than what we have done here today. We have satisfied all of those elements. So I certainly understand Negretti in the sense that you want to see that causal nexus, and a defendant shouldn't be allowed to get up there and say, hey, I was convicted of a crime, and therefore I'm not a permanent resident, I'm not a citizen, therefore I'm likely to be deported, therefore vacate my place. No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is have someone connect the dots. And by connecting the dots, it's not an onerous task. It's very simple and straightforward.
Counselor, what I think your opposing counsel is saying to you, that she agrees with you on the status question,
mm-hmm.
given the type of conviction she had and what the federal law says, she has the status that makes her subject not to being readmitted. But I think the piece that she's arguing with you about is there aren't facts alleged that for this particular woman, the federal government is going to deny admission. And those are the facts I think she says are not in the record.
I think the difficulty...
Can you address why that's
yeah,
not correct?
The difficulty with that is I believe I heard her say she wants someone to come in, an expert, to testify as to what the law is. And she indicated that that necessarily wouldn't have to be an ICE official. She suggested that I may do that. As an attorney, as someone who is primarily an immigration practitioner, that's what I did in my memorandum of law to the court. I explained all of that. And I think that there's really an impracticability, if you will, as far as asking the Department of Homeland Security, whether it's ICE or USCIS, to avail themselves and to give an advisory opinion.
If the court would have given the warnings, you wouldn't be here.
Pardon
or
me?
At least you wouldn't be here the same way, right?
Right.
Because, right? I mean, this is a remedy if the court fails to give the warning.
Correct.
Whereas some of the other cases where the court kind of gave the warnings, but what counsel said, it wasn't really sure. Okay. So why isn't that the answer? Court, you have to give the warnings. Otherwise, everyone's going to have that argument.
Well, yes. I mean, this is something that's been on in the law since 1986. The Duong Mala case came out in 2002. It's in the judicial bench book. I'm not going to admonish any judge, but absolutely. But this particular statute says that the circuit court judge has to personally address, in addition to the other thing, in addition to the plea questionnaire.
The state says your affidavit, your memorandum of law is not enough. You may be absolutely right in your interpretation of the law. You need something else. And that what you need is a statement that the government will do it to your client. So what you almost have to do, which of course you cannot do, is report your client to the Immigration Service and get a commitment from them that they're going to go after your client.
Well, therein lies the rub, obviously. These agencies do not give advisory opinions. And I think the email exchange between myself and Agent House, who's a very nice man, but I'm primarily an immigration law practitioner, and I know of nobody that I would be able to go to. And I also think that those individuals would face, fear, because they're simply saying, yeah, okay, I'm going to give you my opinion. You use my opinion in circuit court to reopen a case of an immigration violator. I think that's a conflict for them to do that.
A little conflict for you, too.
Well, absolutely. If someone is in Ms. Valadez's situation, she's going to be detained the minute she avails herself. And as an immigration practitioner, someone with three young children, I'm not going to put in that position.
Who has the young children? You or Mrs. Valdez?
We both do.
I just wanted to clarify which children are at.
Yeah, correct. I'm sorry.
Thank you, counsel.
Do you need more time? Because we questioned the state, so if you have something you want to say,
I don't think there's anything different. I feel comfortable with it.
Okay. Hiking on Mount Everest or anything like that?
Maybe someday.
Thank you very much. And thank you both for good arguments in what I find to be a very complicated case. I introduced the court before, but I didn't tell the students that a justice would be out after the last argument. If you all can either stay or come back, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley will come and speak with you all and also with the class that will be coming in for the next oral argument. So if you have time, do come back. She won't tell you the answer to the $64 question that we've all been worrying about here, but she will give you some good ideas about how the court operates. So with that, we are in recess until we come back together again to hear the second case of the morning. Thank you.